afternoon.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Manulife event, The Big Fat Truth About Exercise, featuring Dr. Stephen Blair. I'm your host, Jill Barker, fitness columnist for the Montreal Gazette and proud member of the athletics team here at McGill and the wearer of the McGill tie. We're all pretty fortunate to be here today. This is a sold-out event, and why not? Because in the next 90 minutes, we're going to benefit from a better understanding of what it means to be fit. And this is the time of year to do just that. I want to thank the sponsorship and vision of Lawrence Bloomberg and Manulife Financial. Not only do we, everyone here today, get a chance to listen to Dr. Blair's presentation, we've also been going to have a very rare opportunity to dialogue with the inaugural winner of the Bloomberg Manulife Prize. After Blair's presentation, both myself and one of McGill's most inquisitive PhD candidates in exercise physiology will sit down with Blair, we'll ask him a few questions about his research, and then it'll be your turn. So the goal is by the end of the day, we're all going to know a little bit more about what we have to do to stay fit and healthy. Now, to start today's proceedings, I want to introduce Professor Hélène Perrault, Dean of the Faculty of Education and an exercise physiologist in her own right who shares Blair's passion to get up and moving. She's also my running partner. Hélène?
Merci, Jill. Thank you. I don't know if running still qualifies, Jill, but thank you. Welcome to all. Bienvenue à tout le monde. On est content de vous avoir ici à McGill aujourd'hui. C'est une journée spéciale. We're really thrilled to have you all here today with us. And for those of you who read the Gazette, you might have seen in the morning Gazette the article, and I quote, about the rock god of exercise theory, having received the inaugural prize, Bloomberg Manulife Prize, last night in Toronto. And you will have read then that this prize is really dedicated and meant to promote and support research in physical activity, health, and well-being. And it is very fitting that this prize is now allowing us to present to you the first inaugural winner. We were thrilled when we launched this prize last year that in the call for application, we received so many high-quality applications. And we were hoping, we thought, that we should have high calibers, but we never expected that we would be presenting to you today here on campus such a high-caliber scientist, a multiple award winner, whose work has been cited tens of thousands of times in academic journal, and whose message is one that we can all really simply incorporate in our daily lives. Now, I say simply, but I know it's not that easy. Nevertheless, you will hear about it. We weren't never modest in our plans for the Bloomberg Manulife Prize, and we are certainly gratified, but not surprised, that the bar has been set so high for our jury and for the future applicants. I may be biased, but I do believe that McGill's Department of Kinesiology and Physical Education, which is part of our Faculty of Education, is the ideal home for a prize of this nature and caliber. First of all, because the mission and values that the department holds are very much aligned with those of the prize. And also the excellence in the research that it wants to support and translate. And it's very exciting because 2012 marks the 100th anniversary of the Department of Kinesiology and Physical Education. And today's event can be included in the series of events that will mark this year. What a better way to kick off a anniversary year. And I do salute department members that I do see here. Happy birthday, 100 years. It's also appropriate that the initiative, Bloomberg Manulife, also targets the future of research. It supports academic talent through some doctoral fellowships. And thanks to the Bloomberg Manulife Fund, now two very talented PhD candidates have embarked on new doctoral programs in the Department of Kinesiology and Physical Education. And these students are Jeff Caron from Moncton, New Brunswick, and he is researching on the psychological aspects of sports-related concussion. And the second one is Madeleine Purvis-Smith from Carstairs, Alberta, and she is studying the effects of aging on skeletal muscle function and dysfunction. So, as we recognize on this campus, while the mission of academia is to generate and advance knowledge, we also know that its value to society is only captured by its ability to disseminate and translate research into action. And that's exactly what the Bloomberg Manulife Prize contributes to achieve this year, but then year after year. The research that is presented here will be translated, and it will be transmitted not only through academic journals or conferences, but also in a way that it could be translated into changing the ways and practices of people in homes, in clinics, in schools, and in communities all over North America. The Bloomberg Manulife Prize has a very simple but yet highly ambitious objective, and that is to promote research that can improve and prolong life, and that is prolong quality life. It was initiated in 2011, and at that time, four well-recognized academics from Canada and the U.S. agreed to serve as jury for the prize. A host of applications was received and peer-reviewed, and our winner, with an impressive track record, was chosen for the tremendous impact that his research has had on promoting and supporting active health. The prize carries an award of $50,000 to support the research of the winner. And we owe a debt of gratitude to McGill graduate financier and generous philanthropist, Mr. Lawrence Bloomberg, and his wife, Frances, for their commitment in recognizing and supporting this research. Mr. Lawrence Bloomberg, with his wife, Frances, and Manulife Financial, have each pledged $1 million over 10 years to support the prize and a companion doctoral fellowship fund. And Lawrence was most instrumental in bringing this wonderful initiative to life. As I said, Lawrence is a McGill graduate, and he is also, and I can say it here because it is now public, that he is a recent recipient of the Order of Canada. And I'm delighted that he was able to join us today here on campus, and Lawrence is here, and Lawrence, would you please stand to be recognized? And I also want to acknowledge and salute our other very important founding corporate partner, Manulife Financial, a company that I know is very much committed to giving back to the communities it serves. And we see that through the many others' worthy cause that it supports. And I'm equally pleased that Dawn took out her boots this morning, she said, to come to Montreal and be with us today. Dawn is the AVP of Internal Communication and Branding at Manulife Financial, and I'm really happy that she's joining us today. Dawn, could you please just stand up and be recognized? Thank you. And of course, I also would like to recognize our corporate sponsors. And we have with us in this initiative the Globe and Mail, Shaw Media, WestJet Airlines, and the Cambridge Group of Clubs. And so thank you all for your really valuable support. Now, there is an event today. You're not just listening to me talking about this, and I know you're waiting for the rest of it to come. So, we're really fortunate today to have with us Jill and Martin, who will be joining our prize winner and taking part in the conversation, as Jill mentioned. Many of you do know Jill on campus. You might have seen her when you do walk up to Curry Gym. Jill is manager of marketing and communications in athletics and recreation at McGill. You might also know her because you read her column in a Gazette on Tuesdays. It is Tuesday, isn't it, Jill? Thursdays, whatever. Every day would be nice. Jill possesses a wealth of fitness knowledge, as well as a really extensive toolkit of practical exercises and exercise program for the average Canadian who wants to incorporate more physical activity in their daily life. Now, Martin, you could know Martin as well, because he's an award winner as well, in his own right. Martin is a doctoral student in the Department of Kinesiology and Physical Education, and he has received, over the short career, but I must admit, really intense career that he has had as a researcher, numerous fellowships and awards, notably from National Science and Engineering Research Council, the Canadian Institute of Health Research. He's also the recipient this year of the prestigious Prix ACFAS, l'Association Francophone pour le Savoir, le Prix des Jardins for excellence in doctoral research. His picture was in the newspaper a few weekends ago. So thrilled that Martin is with us here. Martin is one of the future areas of our field development, looking at muscle function and more specifically the role of muscle bioenergetics and mitochondria and the role that disease aging activity or the lack of activity may have on our understanding of the role of mitochondria in muscle functions or dysfunctions. So thank you, Martin, for joining us today as well. Now, it is changing now and moving to our prize winner. Great pleasure for me to tell you a little bit more about our inaugural winner, Dr. Stephen Blair. He is a legend. He is a lead contributor to health research, a true pioneer in his field. It was really insightful of him that at a time where heart disease was certainly a prevailing leading cause of death, there was little knowledge of what were the relationships that physical activity may or may not have. We had no knowledge of what were the factors that could contribute to explain heart disease or other leading causes of that. And at that time, Stephen Blair had the insight to say we need to be looking more at what is the role of physical activity. And over the next 30 years, he would become instrumental in linking physical activity with decreased mortality, enhanced health benefits in numerous diseases and in numerous conditions. And he remains one of the most cited scientists worldwide. He's done many things. He's advised governments and health organizations. He's published over 500 scientific paper book chapters. And he's one of a handful of people outside of the U.S. Public Health Services to be awarded the Surgeon General's Medallion. Stephen was also among the first researchers to scientifically demonstrate that even moderate increases in fitness, regardless of one's body weight, translates into significantly reduced mortality rate. You can imagine how that was received. His research has also shown that as little as 30 minutes of physical activity a day is enough to drive down mortality rates by 50%. And that is the lack of physical activity, and not obesity per se, that is the single most important health issue we are facing today. So having worked in his health research areas for over 40 years in various institutions, including the well-known Cooper Institute, Professor Stephen Blair is now at the University of South Carolina, and he has accumulated an outstanding body of research, which he will share with us today, and you will see that it can translate into simple, practical advice, and that it has the potential to change life and to enhance societal health outcomes. One of the objectives, as I said, of the Bloomberg Manulife Prize is exactly to do that, and we could not have had a more fitting inaugural prize winner. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Stephen Blair.
Well, thank you very much, Dean Perot. I am certainly humbled to have received this honor from this outstanding university. I thank you, the faculty, the students, certainly Mr. Bloomberg and Ms. Marchant for supporting the development of this prize, and of course all my colleagues that I've worked with over the years that have helped do this research, and finally Dr. Jane Blair, who's my wife of nearly 47 years and here with me today and has been so supportive over that time. somehow this went to my second slide. Well, anyway, the title was supposed to be The Big Fat Truth About Exercise, but I changed it. It's The Big Fat Truth About Obesity. We're going to focus on a bit here today. And in the interest of full disclosure, as we do in academic settings, here are groups that I have received funding from and have worked with in the last year or so. So, are the health problems caused by overweight and obesity? And they do exist, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying ignore obesity. But have these problems been exaggerated? Yes. Now, thank you for your attention. And are there any questions? That's the story. Well, anyway. What's happening? What are the causes of this obesity epidemic, which clearly exist in this country, my country, and around the world? Well, it's energy balance, as we talk about it in science. It's, you know, the energy in and energy out. If you take in more energy than goes out, that energy has to be stored. Remember the laws of thermodynamics, and it gets stored in the body as fat. If you burn more calories than you take in, then you're going to get that energy from somewhere, and you burn some of the fat, so you'll lose a bit of weight. It's really a very simple concept. I have taught this to our six-year-old grandson. He understands it. He is, of course, a genius, as well as being extremely cute, athletic, and everything else. But it's not understood by a lot of prominent people, prominent scientists. I mean, here's one. We saw this a little over a year ago in the Daily Telegraph, and we were in England for a meeting, and this was a British science festival, and this prominent British scientist said, in 1980, here was the caloric intake in British men and women, and today it is 3,500 calories. Oh, my God. Well, some of you are not in the field, may not know that it takes 3,500 positive caloric balance calories to add 1 pound of fat. So have the Brits really increased? I mean, if this were actually true, the average Brit would, I would say, probably be weighing 10,000 tons now or something like that. And I say, well, there's been no change in physical activity, and therefore all of this is due to change in energy intake. Another very prominent scientist, Professor Swinburne, says this in a WHO report. It's increase in caloric intake that's causing the increase in body weight and the obesity epidemic. So, as a scientist, and I tell this to my students, and they make some statement, I say, well, how do you know that? You know, show me the data. Well, let's look at data from the United States. We have this thing called the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. It's been going on over time for quite an extensive period of time. These are very large, tens of thousands of representative individuals in the United States. So here are the data, and the energy intake diet is assessed by 24-hour dietary recall. When you come in for the exam, a dietitian sits down with you and says, okay, what did you eat yesterday? And go through that. So these show that for the first two of these surveys in men, energy intake was essentially identical. And then, boom, it bumped up a couple hundred, 250 calories. And then these two are essentially equal. And it's a very similar pattern in women, these two. So, yeah, Americans are eating more, so that's got to be the cause of the obesity epidemic. Wrong. Because these data cannot be called trends. There was an enormous change in methodology between these two surveys and these two surveys. It's like if we used a new lab measure to analyze cholesterol and the new measure found more cholesterol in the blood, we couldn't say, well, Canadians have increased their cholesterol. We'd have to take into account the changes in methodology. So what were the changes? Well, in the first two, the 24-hour recalls were done Monday through Friday, and the last two all 7 days of the week. You ever eat more on the weekend, perhaps? Yeah, okay, there's pretty good evidence for that. But other changes, probably more important, the interviewers got a lot more training before the third survey to do more probing. And what the dietitians mean by that, when I say, well, Dean Perot, let's do the 24-hour recall for you yesterday. What time did you get up? And she said, oh, I think about 10 or 10:30, my usual time. Close. I said, did you have breakfast? She said, yes, I did. What did you have? I had some cornflakes and coffee. Well, did you have a snack in the morning? That's what I would have done the first two, sir. But after I trained a little more, I would say, well, did you put anything on your cornflakes? Well, sure, a cup of half and half and 12 teaspoons of sugar. How about your coffee? More half and half. So by probing, I discovered more calories. She didn't actually eat more, I just discovered them. And that, I think, is the major cause for this difference. And it's not only my opinion, it's the opinion of Van Hubbard, I should say Admiral Van Hubbard, who is the director of our National Institutes of Health Nutrition office. He said, you can't call these trends. And here's some other data that one of my PhD students worked up recently. Over this same period of time, I've just shown the data from the NHANES surveys, we know that the average weight of Americans has gone up. Well, you physiologists in the crowd know that resting metabolic rate is a principal source of energy expenditure in the human body. And if you get bigger, it takes more calories just to stay alive. So this shows the increase in calories that would be required just to maintain energy balance because of increases in resting metabolic rate. And then just everything you do over the course of the day, this is PAL, physical activity level, and this is kind of a sedentary average level of PAL, but even just moving around a little bit, again, it costs more if you weigh more. And the people that say want to talk about dietary trends don't seem to take this into account. It's not that difficult a concept. I don't know why they can't grasp it. And the same kind of data are true for women. They weigh more, resting metabolic rate is higher, and just average daily incidental energy expenditure is higher. So let's look at some of the proposed causes of the obesity epidemic. And, of course, a big target is sugar. In the U.S., we're going to start taxing sodas and taxing sugar. And you may have noticed on my acknowledgments, I receive research funding from Coca-Cola. So take what I say with that. And I mean, they don't direct the research. They give the university money, and I do the research, or my team does the research. I try to do as little work as possible. But anyway, in Australia, over this period, this is the percentage of Australians who are obese. Just like the U.S., just like Canada, climbed steadily over this period. Here is sugar intake in Australia. Go in the other direction. I know these are epidemiological data, observational, but if sugar is causing the obesity epidemic, kind of would expect these to go in the other direction. Let's go to the United Kingdom. Very same pattern. Obesity goes up. Sugar rates essentially have gone down just a little bit. U.S., going back even further over the last, back to 1910, these slides show the changes in, this is sugar, this is carbohydrate, this is starch, and this is refined. It doesn't matter. Different measures of sugar and carbohydrates. They went up dramatically in the early part of the 20th century. Obesity rates stayed flat up until the late 70s or early 80s. So it wasn't causing obesity back in those days. And here my PhD student just sent me this yesterday from this article from Japan. According to these data, energy intake in Japan essentially has been flat over the course of the last, 40, 50 years. Protein intake gone up a little bit. They're eating more fat, as they got richer, more of a Western diet, eating more fat. And what really went up was automobile use. And you see this as countries transition. China's been going through this in a huge way in the last decade. And, of course, the obesity rates, or BMI, goes along with that. What about trends in energy expenditure? And again, the people like Swinburne say, well, there's been no increase in physical activity, or physical activity has been the same, so all the obesity epidemic has to be due to increases in energy intake. What they don't seem to understand is that leisure time, self-reported physical activity, which are the data we have in these national surveys, that's not the same as total energy expenditure. As I hinted a moment ago, as you get bigger, it takes more calories just to stay alive. But something that I think, and my young colleague Tim Church led this effort, we think, here's the major cause of the obesity epidemic. U.S. Department of Labor statistics over the past 50 years, is anyone surprised? The number of service jobs went up, mining, manufacturing, et cetera, went down. It was about right here when I said, boy, this hard work on a Kansas farm, it's just too much. And my granddad said, Stevie, get yourself an education and get a job in out of the weather. My poor family, that was the deal. If you could get a job in out of the weather, boy, you had really advanced. So I did. I went to college and got out of agriculture. But I do have some, I still can do this work. Here visiting our friends Ilkka and Eva Vuori in Finland, and Ilkka sent me, said, we want to go to sauna tonight, so go out and saw some wood and chop some wood and get ready for sauna. So here I am. Boy, I'm working my tail off, getting ready. And I finished that task, and I went to find Ilkka. And here's the supervisory work. You see, there's a little difference in energy expenditure between those. So as we look at the change in jobs in the United States over these 50 years, we assign an energy expenditure value, and for those not in the business, METS refers to multiples of resting metabolic rate. So 2 to 2.9 METS is light activity. It's moving around just a little bit. I'm probably close to 2 METS as I get excited here in this talk. A sedentary is really just sitting. That's mainly the sitting work, and you see that's gone up. And, of course, the moderate intensity, this is not hard work, it's just moderate. 3 METS is walking at 5 kilometers an hour. Let me try to get this right. So we assign these energy expenditure values to these trends, and here's what, and we had a brilliant mathematician work with us. She didn't even know what we were doing. Tim just gave her the data and said, make these estimates. In the United States, the average daily occupational energy expenditure is this in men and this in women, and the experts say the entire obesity epidemic can be explained by a positive caloric balance of maybe 70 or 80 calories a day. So this is more than enough. So we then asked Diana, Tim gave her the measured weights from the NHANES surveys. He said in 1962, the average American man weighed this amount. Now, you take our data that you've modeled and estimate the weights of American men at these time points. And she didn't really know what he was doing. She's not a public health person. But at those same time points, we have the measured weights again from NHANES. Look at that in men and women. It's not quite as strong here in later years in women, but the R-squared value, for those of you who are in academia, between estimated occupational energy expenditure decline and body weight is 0.92. Ross, have you ever done a 0.92 R-squared? I don't. The physics lab has trouble doing that. So we think this has to be a major cause. Excuse me, I'm fighting this cold. Now, most of you, maybe not all of the lay people who don't work in this field, but you've heard of body mass index, and you know that starting in the 1990s, the World Health Organization and then various national groups begin to identify normal weight, overweight, and obese BMI categories. Okay? Normal weight, overweight, and obese. Now, here are 10 silhouettes of men from quite skinny to really pretty hefty. So which one of these letters identifies the silhouette that is overweight? This is a pop quiz. Shout out a number. F. D? Who said D? E or F. Okay. Same for women. Which silhouette is overweight? E. G? Okay, well, we're getting a few different numbers. Here's the truth. D is overweight. That guy's overweight? Some of you said E. Somebody even said F. That's at the top of class one obesity. I didn't hear Professor Anderson shout out, but he probably wouldn't have gotten this right either. I've shown this to real experts in diabetes and weight management, and what the reason we're so far off is we've been subjected to the rants about obesity that the picture we have in mind for overweight really is something like this. It's not this, or, well, I took out the picture. Not my favorite president, but W was overweight. BMI 26.5. Regular runner. He and I worked out at the same health club before he became governor. The guy didn't have any fat on his body. Mountain biker. And President Obama, I'm sorry to say, is getting close to being overweight. President Obama. Oh, my gosh. Well, we hype this too much. And here's this term that just, I may have a heart attack. Is there a doctor in the audience? And when I see this term, diabesity, what does that mean? I think literally it means diabetes and obesity are the same thing. That's what it suggests. Is that true? We hear a lot about obesity and diabetes, and I was on a program with one of the obesity experts not long ago, and he carried on at great length about diabetes in kids. He said, we used to call this adult onset diabetes. Now we have to call it type 2 diabetes because it's so common. I go to my son's middle school. I see these fat kids out there playing. So I, oh, my God. And you listen to him, and you think, gosh, most American kids have type 2 diabetes. He never actually mentioned a number, but that was the impression you would get. So another pop quiz. Oh, I already gave the answer, so you get it. The rates of diagnosed type 2 diabetes in Americans under 45, I'm not saying it's unimportant, but it's 1.4%, which is higher than it was in 1980, so you know, it's trends going in the wrong direction. But it's not as though everybody has diabetes. And, there it was in 1980. Now, what is it then in children, adolescents, those under age of 19, with or under age 20, with type 2 diabetes? Anyone want to shout that out? No, you're already suspicious of me. It's 0.26%. It exists, but I have a colleague who is in a study called SEARCH, which is Search for Type 2 Diabetes in Children, and they really have to look hard to find these. It's a very rare condition. Let's not exaggerate. How many deaths are due to obesity in the United States? And I don't know the Canadian data. And which causes more deaths? Well, I can ask this pop quiz. Which causes more deaths in the population, smoking or diabetes or obesity? Smoking. Yeah, you're on to me already. And 40% of U.S. adults think it's about equal. 20% actually say obesity causes more. And the truth is, smoking causes over 400,000, obesity causes 110,000, and this is without taking physical activity into account. And we're going to come to that in a moment. You don't have to be an epidemiologist or public health expert. I'm not doing a pop quiz here, but everybody knows most deaths in the population occur in what? Old people. So 1.6 million deaths in the U.S., not too many in the younger groups. And we have many, many, many studies showing that body mass index is completely unrelated to mortality in older people. So if most deaths are in older people, obesity is not even related to mortality in older people, it cannot be as big a problem as some people want you to believe. And Catherine Flegel from the CDC published this a few years ago. These are the number of deaths expected in underweight individuals, the reference category is the normal weight. So underweight is risky if you're too skinny. I've been working against getting in that category for a long time. If you're overweight, she calculates actually 86,000 fewer deaths in overweight Americans than would be expected. If you're in class 1 obesity, there is an increase of about 30. And this paints a different picture when you actually look at the data. So let's come to the issue of fitness and fatness and mortality. Our first report, and if any of you are part of the obesity cartel and you want to blame this crazy research, crazy ideas I'm throwing out, you can blame a Canadian, because it was Claude Bouchard, who was having a meeting in Quebec City as an ancillary meeting to the International Obesity Conference that came up the next week in Toronto. And he said, Steve, why don't you look at the question of fitness and fatness and how they relate to mortality? So it's his fault. And when we did that, before I get to that, take a look. I don't like to subject people to putting them on the scale. Because, if somebody, oh, my God, look at that, 100 kilograms. It's embarrassing. So I have a student sit there and estimate the weights. We did a study to validate the kid's estimates, and it's valid. Okay? So here from our first report, at this time, normal weight was BMI of less than 27, and then it got hijacked up in 1998 and made something like 40 million Americans overweight overnight because we just changed the definition to 25. But here are the death rates across low, moderate, and high fit groups. Fitness measured by a maximal exercise test on a treadmill. This is the bottom 20%. If you do the 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week, you'll be in the moderately fit category. You don't have to be a marathon runner. So you see this gradient across low, moderate, and high fitness. Oh, and it's true in what was in the overweight category. Now, there aren't a lot of high-fit, obese individuals. If you look around very carefully, you can find at least one in this room. But so in this analysis, we combine the moderate and high-fit categories. But look at the death rate in the fat guys who are moderate or high-fit. That's about, 18 or 19 per 10,000. And compare that to the death rate in the normal weight guys who are not fit, more than twice as high. Now, when I presented this over in Quebec, a famous British said, what a lot of rubbish that is! And then others said, well, the findings are counter to what we know. Well, if we have revealed knowledge on these things, why do we do research? Let's just go with what we know. And then there were some legitimate points. Well, maybe the people with a high BMI, maybe they're all like me. It's not fat, it's muscle. And maybe you didn't take that into account. The obese guys who are fit, they're just muscular and fit. And maybe smoking was too big a confound, or maybe you didn't take health status into account. So, and by the way, before I go to the next study, I was lying to you a moment ago. It's the only time I'll lie today. Of course we measure not only height and weight, we measure body composition in the laboratory. The reason I put this up is when people in the obesity field, if they even take physical activity into account in their studies, and there are papers every week in the world scientific literature on obesity and health outcome X where physical activity, the words don't even appear in the article. There will be one this week, maybe more. But when they do take activity into account, they say we used a self-reported leisure time physical activity questionnaire, and we validated it, and the correlation was 0.4. So that means their questionnaire accounts for 10% of the truth, or 15% of the truth in the actual measure. Well, I think that's kind of garbage myself. And when you heard me say, yeah, we just estimated, you thought, what kind of nut is that? How did he get this prize? Yeah. No, we need to measure these things carefully and take them into account in the analysis. So here we actually are looking at percent body fat determined in the laboratory. These are the normal fat guys, kind of over a little bit over fat, and here are the obese guys, and the fit ones and the unfit ones. And this is risk of dying from any cause, the risk of dying from cardiovascular disease. And you see that in every case, it's the unfit ones who are dying. In fact, again, the fat guys who are at least moderately fit have a death rate about one-half that of the thin guys who are not fit. Yeah, I love it. Okay, well, I'm going to go on. More recent paper of men and women 60 years of age and older. Here are the ones who were fit by the treadmill test. Again, fatness measured in the laboratory. These are the normal fat. These are overfat or obese. Here are the unfit ones. There's no difference between death rates and between the fat and the not fat. The difference is between the fit and the unfit. That is what is much more important. Now, keep in mind, I have not said no obesity problem, ignore it, etc. I am saying it is hyped, over-exaggerated, and the science is not very good because too many of them have not even taken activity, much less fitness or objectively measured activity, into account. So, our most recent paper on this topic, published just last month in the Circulation, in this case we looked at 14,000 men who had at least two exams, and I think the average number of exams was four or five over a many-year period. So we could model their change in fitness, change in fatness, etc. Over 900 deaths occurred in nearly 12 years of follow-up, and we tried to look at people who were, you know, healthy at baseline and so forth. Well, here are the data on all-cause mortality by fifths of change in percent fat, body weight, and maximal MET performance on the treadmill. You see, these guys are middle-aged, 47 or something like that at baseline, and changing their weight or fat in either direction really made no difference at all to their risk of dying. Made no difference at all. But if they improved their fitness, their risk lowered. And the same is true for cardiovascular disease. So the next time one of you is a little bit hefty, goes to the doctor, and the doctor says, well, you're too fat, you need to lose some weight, remind them of this study, and especially if the doctor doesn't even mention exercise. And in the U.S., 20-25% of the medical encounters, the physician might mention exercise. The vast majority, they don't even bring it up. Now, I defy you, I think it's the same here in Canada, I defy you to go to the doctor for a visit and get out of there without having them weigh you. Can't do it. No, we got to get that vital sign. We need the same for activity. We need a new strategy for dealing with obesity. What we've been doing isn't working. And just to use another example, this is recently the 40-year anniversary of President Nixon's war on drugs. Two principal strategies in the United States: keep them out and lock people up who use them. And these strategies are working extremely well in the United States. UN reported the global, and it's the same in the United States. Look at the increases. Up, up, up. The number incarcerated for drug use, look at that. And California is going bankrupt because they got all these people that smoke marijuana in prison, spending more on them per year than if they gave them a free ride to Stanford University. Is this sensible? Let's get a little more sensible in the way we deal with these problems. Let's try to deal with the obesity epidemic, and of course I really want to deal with the physical inactivity epidemic. We've got to take this seriously. We need a broad-based program that reaches across kind of all sectors of society. It's not just enough for doctors to ask about physical activity. So my final message, let's stop talking about weight and obesity. Let's focus on healthful eating. I'm not a dietitian, but I know enough. Eat your fruit and vegetables. Grandma taught me that. I think she had a high school education, but she knew that was good. And focus on whole grain rather than highly processed grain. Not too much fat, especially trans fat. And some alcohol. People in our study with zero alcohol have higher death rates than those are from 1 to 14 drinks a week. So be in that category. Don't be over 14, because that's even worse. And, of course, regular physical activity, 3 10-minute walks a day, 5 days a week, will give you the 150 minutes a week. It is now our recommendation. It's your recommendation in Canada. It's the World Health Organization recommendation. This 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week, can save your life, certainly make a big difference in your health. And this is true whether you're man or woman, middle-aged or old, tall or short, whether you are normal or have all that ugly hair on top of your head, whether you're thin or whether you're fat, These are good good strategies and good advice, and we need to promote these much more. Now, here's a guy. I mean, he is fully committed to physical activity, and walking is his favorite activity, at least for his dog. So, come on, guy, get out of that chair. Take that dog out for a walk. You'll both be better off. And again, acknowledging my many colleagues, students, et cetera, is physical activity more important than obesity? Yes, it is. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. So now we're going to move to the second part of the program, if Martin wants to come up. And we're going to sit down with Dr. Blair and ask him some questions that we prepared beforehand and made some notes on today's lecture. Martin is going to start, and I will follow. And then after that, of course, we're going to turn the questions over to you. So if you want to make some notes, then we'd be happy to hear from you as well.
I have to sit in the middle.
Oh, just have to do that.
I can take orders from a student.
Great. So, where you go, Martha?
Okay. You talk about being fit and about fitness being, you know, more important than body weight and BMI. But what does it mean to be fit? You know, what happens in the body for in someone that's fit?
Dean Perot, would you like to come up and answer that question? A physiologic question. Well, what are the pathways, the metabolic physiologic pathways? There are a lot of them, I think many that no one's ever thought of yet. 30 years ago, I would have said, well, it improves your HDL cholesterol and your blood pressure, and probably does a little bit, but that doesn't explain the benefit. Sympathetic, parasympathetic balance is a more recent mechanism. People who are sedentary have a very poor balance and have a very regular heart rate. You get them involved in just a little exercise very quickly, they get to the irregular healthy. So those are examples. It's up to you and these other students and young investigators to keep searching for these mechanisms. There must be many we haven't even thought of. But let me just add, we've never been able to make the association between fitness and health go away by adjusting for a wide, wide range of variables. And the data that from the exams that we use, a 3 or 4 hour exam, we've got a huge amount of laboratory data, and we can't make the association go away. So it's things that certainly are not routinely measured.
Okay. So it doesn't seem like it's about one organ being better, you know, but the heart working better and the muscles being...
I think it's about all organs, probably.
Okay.
The lungs, the heart, certainly the muscles are very key here.
And even though we've gathered from your talk that physical activity and fitness is very important, we know that diet also plays an important role, and you've mentioned that. So would you say that physical activity, or rather inactivity, and eating too much, for example, synergize to predispose us to disease? Do they work together?
Well, both diet and activity are important. I mean, I clearly agree with that. The evidence that there's much association between people's exercise habits and dietary habits is really not very strong. I mean, people think, oh, yes, you're a runner, so you eat the healthiest possible diet. Well, maybe you do, maybe you don't. I mean, we haven't found a lot of association there. So, again, focus on both. I don't think one is necessarily dependent on the other. I obviously am quite convinced that it's the exercise that's a lot more important if you are able to get enough calories to stay alive. I mean, none of us want to starve. But remember, we evolved to be active creatures. We also evolved to eat anything we could find to put in our mouth. So the dietitians say, and I agree, I don't think there are any bad foods. There are probably foods that you can eat too much of, but I don't have to be afraid that, oh, this is going to kill me if I eat it.
So there's a lot of data available that you've generated in the last 40 years. Do we know enough, and it's just a matter of implementing it, or do we still need to know more and discover more, you know, about the mechanisms? Do you think that's important, or do you think we have enough to go forward?
Well, I think it will be fun for the physiologists and others to continue to look at mechanisms. We know plenty about the effects of exercise fitness on health. I still want to do research on that. That's what I do. It keeps me amused. But If I were the emperor of biomedical research funding in the United States, I would dramatically ramp up the research on how to get people to be active, the behavioral science, how to develop and implement policies that will increase activity on the community level. We're not giving enough attention to those things. Those are newer research areas, and they are beginning to function, but we need a lot more money in that. I'll even accept a cut in epidemiology, and I'll certainly accept a cut in physiology funding. We need to invest more in policy and intervention, I think. Okay. Good question.
In your opinion, should the strategies be aimed at, you know, the education, or mostly at changing, you know, what people have access to, or changing, you know, how the society, you know, works in general?
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay.
In the U.S., a couple of years ago, we released our first ever... Are we getting an echo? Are you hearing it out there? Maybe if I move it down a little bit. Okay. Can you hear me? We released our first ever national physical activity plan, and it's built around 8 sectors. You mentioned education. I forget what else you mentioned. I can never remember all 8, but education, public health, clinical medicine, business and industry, not-for-profits, media. That's 6. There are 2 more. Transport and urban planning. We need to address issues in all of those areas to make, and I think somebody told me, Ross, and maybe he was telling the truth, that Montreal is the 7th most bike-friendly city in the world, or in the world. So you people here are doing well. In Columbia, South Carolina, we do have a bike lane. But I think it's on a very busy street, and it's at least 200 meters long, something like that. So we've got a bike lane. We have a ways to go. But we need a lot of things. Make communities more friendly. Certainly, we do a terrible job, I think, in education. In health education, physical education, education in general, in teaching people about behavioral science and the concepts of behavioral strategies and principles that people can use to manage behavior, their own personal behavior. And whether that's diet or physical activity or flossing your teeth or balancing your checkbook or whatever. And we don't really teach that very well in the U.S. And I'm not opposed to other kinds of science. We need chemistry, biology, physics, and so forth. We also need more behavioral science.
All right, my turn. Do you feel that the public has received a consistent message in terms of how much exercise is enough to benefit health?
Yes, I do. We've been quite consistent, certainly since the early 1990s. We've been a lot more consistent than the dietary recommendations. But in the 70s and 80s, the exercise scientist, the physiologist, we thought you had to do pretty intensive exercise to get benefits. And Marty Carvenan studied that systematically almost 60 years ago now. And we thought you had to do 70% of your maximal capacity to get benefit. We began to learn that isn't true. And in 1992, our American Heart Association made physical inactivity the 4th risk factor, joining smoking, high blood pressure, high cholesterol. And in that, I think, was the first kind of official recommendation where we said moderate amounts and intensities of activity are good for you. And then in 1995, our CDC and American College of Sports Medicine issued a landmark report. Some of you met Russ Pate last night, my colleague who led that effort. It was published in JAMA in 1995, and the last time I checked, it was the 8th most highly cited paper in the history of JAMA. It's got to be the most highly cited paper in the exercise field. And that's where, at that time, we said 30 minutes a day of moderate on most, preferably all days of the week. And that kind of gradually evolved. Well, 30 minutes, 5 days a week. And in our most recent recommendations, your country and my country, as I said, we just say, 150 minutes a week in bouts of 10 minutes or more. So 3 10-minute walks a day, 5 days a week will get you to that target. It'll make you moderately fit and give you those benefits I've been talking about.
So what if I'm the classic weekend warrior and I put my 150 minutes in 2 days?
That's a very good question, and we don't have much data on it. My friend and colleague, Ayman Lee at Harvard, did publish a paper called The Weekend Warrior and looked exactly at that. That's the only one I know of on that topic. And as I remember, the weekend clearly a weekend warrior is better off than a seven-day slug, not doing anything. Whether it's better than, say, doing 5 days or 6 days, spreading it out, I don't think we know for certain, but if I had to bet, it's better to do it on a pretty regular basis for a couple of reasons. If you say, well, I'm going to try to get my 30 minutes every day, then a couple of things come up during the week and you miss, okay, you're still getting the 150 minutes a week. And then you physiologists can explain far better than I can, there are acute changes that occur with a single bout of exercise, right? Blood pressure comes down immediately after exercise. Blood glucose, insulin sensitivity. We get immediate changes, and they last for some several hours. So to get those repeated, we need to also think about the acute benefits. For that reason, I favor saying, well, try to be active most days.
So what about what I think we called the activities of everyday life, you know, the vacuuming and the gardening and so on. For a while, that was all the rage, and that was included in your 150 minutes. Now we seem to tend toward use words like purposeful exercise. Is there a difference?
Well, I think there's a difference. I don't agree that the recommendations have gone away from lifestyle activities. Certainly the U.S. recommendations haven't. It doesn't matter. Your body doesn't know whether you're walking along at 5 kilometers an hour or you're doing some vigorous dusting in the house or trimming hedge or those kind of things. Your body doesn't know. Your brain might know, but your body doesn't know. So it doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't have to be purposeful. I'm not opposed to purposeful exercise, going to the gym. That's fine. And if that's what works for you, or you and Elaine meet and run, well, that's fine. Purposeful, and that's great. But there are other ways. Not everybody's going to do that. And there are other ways. These 3 10-minute walks up a day. I'm a little hesitant, but I'll go ahead. This is a liberal academic audience. I mentioned this on the radio yesterday in Toronto, and the interviewer kind of clamped down on me. But my office is in the Public Health Research Center. 2.5 blocks away is the main public health building. And I try to make it a point that Jane and I go for a walk 45 minutes or an hour or more every morning. I also try to make a point that at least once during the day, one of my toilet visits is to the School of Public Health. You know, take that break, gets me another 10, 15 minutes of walking, gets me up. I have no data on this. I don't think we have much in the literature. But if you're sitting there hammering away at your computers, sedentary jobs, as most of us have, you've been there 2 or 3 hours, if you get up and take a 5-minute walk, you feel better. You say, well, I feel better. And you, I think you can concentrate better. Area where we need more research, but at the end, it doesn't have to be purposeful.
So most of your examples have been about cardiovascular exercise. How about strength training or something that's popular as well, yoga and Pilates, which, you know, a lot of the population is doing. Do those infer the same type of benefits?
Thank you very much for your question. I hate strength training, but it is part of our recommendations. We say in the U.S., and I think it's the same here, 2 days a week of resistance training using all major muscle groups. I have never liked doing it. I used to do it when I worked out in a fitness center when I lived in Dallas. But now, in the new year, we just got a TechnoGym Kinesis installed in our home office. So if you invite me back next year, I'll be really ripped because we're gonna get on this resistance. It is important. And for some, particularly older, some balance training probably has some benefits. Avoid falling. And people in the older age group know that, yeah, you begin to lose your balance. And so that. Yoga, I don't think we have a lot of evidence on yoga and health. It's probably satisfying. And again, I'm no expert in the area. I was surprised maybe a decade ago when Tai Chi became popular. And you'd see people just doing a Tai Chi. How can that be of any value? And then people did research on it, and it does have physiologic benefits. So, and yoga may well. I'm not aware of the research.
Do you think that men and women respond differently or the same to exercise?
Yes. they really do. I mean, obviously the death rates are lower in women. And the reason for that is that men are much more sensitive and caring individuals. And it's more stressful that way. But, it's obviously a hormone thing. After menopause, the rates get pretty much the same. But, no, I think the physiologic adaptations, the health benefits are very, very similar in men and in women. And they're similar, across racial and ethnic groups. Epidemiologists like say, you look in the journals, the limitations. This is a limited population. It's mostly Caucasian. You just have to put that in. But no researcher I know has ever had a random sample of all human beings who ever lived, which it would take to be really representative. But anyway, on the fitness and mortality that I've talked about, my colleague Susumu Sawada at the Tokyo Gas Company has fitness data. He's published data you can just lay right on top of ours. These are Japanese blue-collar workers. It looks just like the American, mostly Caucasian, executive-level men and women.
So it's January, and I've made my New Year's resolutions. And
so have I. Use the Kinesis.
Great. But I'm only allowed one. Should it be exercising more or eating less?
Yeah, well, you probably get enough exercise. I mean, if you're a regular runner, I mean, doing more is fine. It's probably not going to add a whole lot. I mean, the big difference in health between low fit, moderate fit, and then high fit was a little lower. Although in our data, I told Mr. Bloomberg this last night, you go all the way out to the most fit 5%, they actually have a slightly lower death rate than the next 5%. So you do continue to get some benefits. My advice is follow those simple nutritional points I threw out, fruit and vegetables, etc. Eat what you like, eat when you're hungry, get plenty of exercise. You do that, your weight will stabilize or even begin to come down a bit.
Great.
Nutrition is important, don't get me wrong. Exercise is more important.
Thanks very much. So now we're going to turn the questions over to the audience. Do we have microphones in the audience? Yes? Great. So we're going to ask if we can just make sure you speak loudly, and we'll limit it to one question, and you can always come back if we've got time. So.
Hi there. I'm Kaviri Dasgupta. I'm a professor here at McGill, and I'm one of those doctors that actually does talk about exercise a little bit. So I have a question for you. I'm looking for your advice and your blessing, both combined. And that's because the research that I'm conducting is to really find ways, as physicians in our regular clinical practices, ways of easily translating some of these health messages, which, as you say, are very relatively simple. So after three kicks at the can, I got funding from the Canadian Institutes of Health Research to conduct a clinical trial that involves comparing a strategy of advice versus step count prescription integrated into the follow-up of diabetic and hypertensive patients. Mm-hmm. And so what we are doing, and we'll start recruiting soon, is the physicians that are involved in the intervention arm will give their patients a written prescription to perform certain increase in step counts each day. The overall goal is over a one-year period to increase the step counts by 3,000 steps per day, but the rate of increase is going to be different depending on their baseline activity. And they'll see, this will be just part of their routine three-monthly diabetic or hypertensive visit. The other group will have the same visits but won't get that prescription. And we're going to look as our primary outcome at arterial stiffness as a measure, but we will be looking at fitness and individual vascular risk factors. So first of all, I'm hoping for your blessing. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is, what do you think the impact of that will be on fitness? Because I do have some doubts that it will change fitness substantively, but the data that we've collected in observational studies and others have collected suggests that there may be improvements in our primary outcome as well as the vascular risk factors.
So you certainly have my blessing. This is exactly the kind of study we need to see in clinical settings. So good on you and good luck with the study. We brought pedometers in to behavioral interventions and physical activity interventions back in the early 90s. I am a believer that, first of all, using them for self-monitoring behavior, for goal setting, I mean, these things work, and I think that is an excellent strategy. Will it improve fitness? Yes. If you get these people to increase their activity 3,000 steps a day, fitness levels will improve. We conducted one of the largest tightly controlled single center dose response exercise trials in 464 postmenopausal, overweight or obese, mildly hypertensive women, randomly assigned them to control, three different doses, moderate intensity, 50% of capacity, and the low dose group got about 72 minutes a week, the moderate dose 140 and 220 or something like that. And the low-dose group improved VO2 max 5% compared to controls. And they wore step counters. I think the low-dose group, they didn't increase any more than 3,000 steps a day and maybe even a little less. So, yeah, if you get them to do 3,000 steps a day, you will see changes.
So I may be emailing you for more advice in the future. Thank you very much.
I'm a retired self-proclaimed athlete, and I was reading the China study. That's a best-selling book, and it was identifying when you're an athlete, you require a lot of protein to replace what you lose during the exercise, and they identified that in China, who have had no protein historically, now are eating as affluence allows them to. And they're having very serious problems with cancer, which is the second killer after heart disease. But could you comment on the fact that eating protein, I guess, is a bad thing on the China study? I'm sure we take it for granted.
I don't know that book or the data that you refer to. And again, I am not a dietitian. But I think our dietary guidelines, and I'll bet they're pretty similar here, what are they, 15% of calories from protein or 15, 17, something like that, then that's perfectly adequate. Now, if you're really a absolutely crazy muscle building, I'm going to compete in the Mr. Universe kind, you might need more protein than that, I don't know, to build those muscles. But I think we put far too much emphasis on the macronutrients. Again, kind of eat what you like and get a balance, not too much fat, although we're learning that fat isn't as hazardous as we once thought it was. And carbohydrates are not hazardous, I'm sorry. Neither is sugar hazardous. You could eat too much protein, I suppose. One other thing I want to say, I bet it's the same here. You go into any U.S. drugstore, supermarket, and go to the magazine rack, and what do you see? Dozens of magazines. The covers are mostly women, but some men, all scantily clad, all body beautiful, and notes on there about, try my secret diet or eat my secret supplement or belly fat burning foods and my secret workout. Almost all that stuff is fraudulent. I mean, just ignore it. I mean, if you really want something, you could buy my book. Seriously, there's a huge amount of fraud out there in the dietary area and in the physical activity area. And it's not as complicated as simple, I guess, as some of them want you to believe. Believe what I say when it's simple. 30 minutes a day, 2 days a week, resistance training, eat a balanced diet, eat your fruit and vegetables, go for it.
You would assume you're not fit if you drop dead at an age earlier than expected. You can't tell if you're fit or not if you're fat. You can't tell if you're fit or not by your body mass index. How can you tell if you are fit?
A good question. And, of course, classical way that in the studies I've talked about and what people do here in the physiology lab is put people on the treadmill or cycle ergometer and take them up to maximum and make all kinds of measurements. I mean, that's the classical laboratory way of doing that. Well, I don't think you guys have a big enough lab to test all Canadians in VO2 max. You know, it might be a bit of a struggle. But so people, we don't have to do that. And again, I suppose it's similar here in fitness centers or YMCAs. You can get a non-clinical, maybe submaximal fitness test that is valid and will give you a good estimate of your fitness. But for the public in general, get those 10,000 steps a day or get the 150 minutes of activity a week. You do that, you will be moderately fit unless you have, well, Claude Bouchard can show you that there are some people who just don't respond to exercise very much with improving fitness, but it's a tiny minority. So I think we need to focus on the behaviors. And measuring fitness is fine, and you can get that done. Contact Dean Perot. There's another in the back.
Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Michael Konevsky. I'm a family doctor and acupuncturist. I just moved from New York City, actually, and I'm just inspired by your research, your work, and I kind of wanted to share a clinical anecdote that ends in a question, because here we're talking about just overall fitness. I'm going to go so far as to say I've seen a patient practically cure themselves of their diabetes and hypertension. And I have this gentleman, he's in his late 40s, he's on two oral medications and insulin for his diabetes with an A1C of about 8, which is like, okay, I'd love it to be better. And he's hypertensive in the high 130s. So he went on a trip to Europe, and I should mention he's also moderately obsessive compulsive, which really worked in my favor because I tend to talk a lot about, you know, your 10,000 steps a day, and in New York City I think we're okay at doing that, which is exciting. But he is an accountant, so he can't really do his 10,000 steps a day. But he went on a trip to Europe, and he, I found out after the fact, left all his medicines at home, which was strange given his tendency towards obsessiveness. And he came back, and he starts telling me this, and I look at him, and he looks like he's lost about 20 pounds. Looks pretty good, usual energy. He has all his logs of all his numbers and all his data and his measurements, and he says, "Doc, I have some good news and bad news." I said, "Okay, sure. Tell me." "Well, you know, I just got back from my vacation and I forgot all of my medicines at home." I said, "Well, what, I mean, you look great. What do you mean? You like your insulin too?" "Yeah, my insulin." "Your metformin?" "Yeah." "Your hydrochlorothiazide?" "Yeah." "Well, did you get medicine there? Did you go to a clinic there?" "No. You know what I did? I finally listened to you. I walked for 5 hours a day."
Obsessive-compulsive, you
said,
right?
Exactly. But, you know, and I always talk about it, and I really feel strongly about it, and my dog is the healthiest thing I've ever done in my life for myself for that reason. But this guy, just miraculous. And kind of leading to my question, where and when is the research going in that direction going to start? Because I'm sure that Pfizer and Merck wouldn't be very happy if we started proving these things. But as an integrative doc, for me, this is like, it's beautifully simple, and you're doing it. So how can we make that happen?
Well, there is research on related topics. Again, Tim Church, that I continue to work with, we had a paper published in JAMA maybe 6 months ago in which we had patients with type 2 diabetes who did, they were assigned a control to aerobic exercise, resistance exercise, or combo. Resistance and aerobic, and the combo group did better, and hemoglobin A1C was the primary outcome. Now, they weren't doing the 5 hours a day that your patient did. They weren't able to throw away all their medicine, but there's an initiative. Exercise is medicine. It's not the only medicine, but doctors need to think of it as another medicine for hypertensive patients, for patients with cardiovascular disease, for patients with diabetes. It's another medicine. For patients with diabetes, we have a paper with depression, a paper published recently with Dr. Madhukar Trivedi from UT Southwestern in Dallas, head of the depression clinic, took patients that had failed to get remission of depression with drugs. And then we randomly assigned them to low-dose and high-dose exercise, and both groups improved in depression. So it's not that all patients with depression, I'm saying, don't give them drugs. But in this case, drugs didn't work. but exercise worked pretty well. And physicians need to explore those things.
Are there any other questions? Oh, one more. We have time for one more.
I was just wondering, is the 150 minutes really the minimum that you need to get the benefits, or is it a case that a tiny bit is better than nothing? I mean, if someone's getting 10 minutes a week, might they as well stop wasting their time, or they're still going to get something from it?
It's like all other, say, heart disease risk factors, blood pressure, cholesterol. We have these targets. You know, 140 over 90 is hypertension. You're above that, it's not good. However, 141 is better than 160. And 139, okay, you're below that target, you're still not as well off as if you got to 120. So it's a continuous relationship. So the experts around the world, including Canada, we've looked at the data and debated this, and we say, well, 150 minutes a week of moderate looks like a pretty good target to put out there. And I should go on to say, or 75 minutes of vigorous, or mix and match, with each minute of vigorous being equivalent to 2 minutes of moderate. Yeah, 2 minutes. So you could run 1 or 2 days a week, and the rest of it could be moderate walking. But it's a target. We also have, and I think you do as well, another target. You get even more benefits, and for some diseases like breast cancer and so forth, it seems the higher dose is more important. 300 minutes of moderate. That's only an hour 6 days a week, or 150 minutes of vigorous. So whatever you get, so 149 minutes, hey, that's pretty good. And the study I just mentioned, remember, in the postmenopausal women, 72 minutes a week of moderate produced important changes. So I think 10 minutes a week is better than 0 minutes a week. It's a continuous gradient.
So that concludes the question and answer part of the program, and I'll just reintroduce Dean Perrault, who will say thanks to Dr. Blair for a great presentation.
I don't have to say it, you just said it. No, I did want to thank you, Stephen, for the presentation, but also Jill, and for the questions, Martin, for insightful questions. I think you got some good answers for your put in your final thesis submission there. And I wanted to thank you all for participating. But before we all go down, I did want to give you something as a token of appreciation. And I know that Jane is here, and Dr. Jane Blair, I have something for you too. And I don't know if you would want to join us here up on stage.
That'd be a McGill t-shirt.
I didn't think that would be a McGill t-shirt.
Thank you. So maybe you can come and pick up this, and I'm going to, you can open it.
Oh, this is great. We'll match.
You can open it. There you go.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. If you're looking elsewhere, you walk the streets on that bike path. There you go. Yeah. So, thank you very much for being here. Thank you. Thank you all for participating. We did hope that as part of this prize, the ability to really promote and enhance these kinds of discussion is a way to really disseminate it and start making changes and getting into the community, into the culture, and getting the message out and promoting that translation of research into action that we really want to do. So we really thank you for being here. Again, a great event. Thanks to people who had really vision on supporting that. Thank you very much. And please stay tuned. We're very fortunate that Dr. Blair has agreed to visit the department for a couple of days. And so he will be with us again over the next 2 days. And he will be speaking again tomorrow on campus at 11 o'clock at the Strathcona Anatomy and Dentistry Building. And room 236, I believe, if people are interested. And the title is going to be The Biggest Public Health Problem. And I know that in his bag he has a lot of more data that we haven't seen and we haven't discussed. So please join us if you want to. Thank you very much, and have a good afternoon.